Welcome to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. Imagine you're the victim of a mugging or a stabbing, or that your brother was murdered. Would you want to know the attacker? What might help your healing process? Well, perhaps surprisingly, many victims have a deep need to understand what happened and to forgive. And that's part of the philosophy behind restorative justice. It's a movement that aims to heal and rehabilitate both victim and offender. And we're going to hear about how it works during this hour. The United States has the highest incarceration rate in the world. In fact, a quarter of all of the world's prisoners are in American institutions. But is that making us safer? In California, prison overcrowding became such an issue that a state of emergency was declared in 2006. And in 2011, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the overpopulation problem in our state violates the Eighth Amendment prohibiting cruel and unusual punishment. We've long heard about the need to imprison criminals for public safety and punishment. But what about rehabilitation? And what about providing healing for the victims of these violent crimes? Neither of these have been priorities for the criminal justice system in the late 20th century, but that may be changing. On today's show, we're going to discuss how restorative justice can open up a dialogue between victim and perpetrator. And we'll ask if that might help create a safer society. So joining us to talk about how restorative justice works, we've got Sonia Shaw, who's the advocacy director of the Insight Prison Project, which was founded in 1997, and it's dedicated to reducing recidivism, preventing re-victimization, and serving public safety through rehabilitation programs inside of San Quentin State Prison. Hi, Sonia.
Hi, Holly.
Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Sonia is also a board member for Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth and a board of trustee member for the California Institute of Integral Studies, where she's a professor of interdisciplinary studies as well. We're also joined by Dion Wilson, who is the Survivor Outreach Coordinator for Californians for Safety and Justice. Hi, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you so much.
Dion's husband, a San Leandro police officer, was killed in the line of duty, and she now reaches out to communities and survivors of crime, seeking partnerships to address the root causes of crime in an effort to break the cycle of violence and incarceration. We're also joined by phone by Jerry Elster, who is a formerly incarcerated man from South Central Los Angeles. He lives in El Cerrito now, and he likes to say that some people go to Penn State, and he went to the state Penn. Hi, Jerry.
How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for joining us. Jerry works for, we've got a bit of a bad line there. Jerry works for legal services for prisoners with children under a project called All of Us or None, and he participated in the Insight Prison Project programs when he was in San Quentin serving 27 years of a life sentence for second-degree murder. He's now outside, and he's a facilitator for the Insight Prison Project. Do we have a better line for you now, Jerry?
Yes.
Oh, good. Okay. Thank you. Well, so, Sonia, why don't we start with you, and you can kind of explain to us how this restorative justice works, especially inside of prisons. So, like, I get how it's working in schools and maybe for juvenile crimes, but it seems harder to grasp how this works with something like a murder or a really violent crime.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Holly. So I want to start out by saying that restorative justice invites a fundamental shift in how we do and think about justice. So we know that our current criminal justice system is based on retribution. Retribution meaning punishment, an eye for an eye. If I commit a crime, you know, basically lock me up, throw away the key, take away all my resources, and expect that somehow I'm going to change, figure out what I've done, and that's what justice is. Now, we know that there's a lot missing from that. We know that in that process, what's missing is nobody actually asks me as a person who's committed a crime what I've done, and nobody actually really gives me an opportunity to take accountability. And on the side of a survivor, the victim of a crime, nobody asks that victim what they need, what the impact of the harm was, and actually, what does a victim think that the obligation is on the side of the person that's committed the harm? Victims are just used often to convict. So restorative justice basically invites a very different process of repairing harm. It takes into account crime survivors' needs, community safety, public safety, you mentioned that, accountability, and really actually getting to the root causes of harm. So it plays itself out in many ways. You mentioned schools is one of the arenas. What does it look like on the ground? Because really, it's a set of practices. So there's the schools-based practices, there are community practices, but we're focusing on the justice system and the prison. So two ways that that works is mainly there are two restorative practices. One is the victim-offender dialogue, and the other one is something called restorative group conferencing. I'm going to focus a little bit on victim-offender dialogue.
Okay, and that's something that's happening inside of San Quentin and 12 other prisons in California?
Right. So, and the offshoot of that is the program that we run. It's called the Victim-Offender Education Group. Our program is running in 12 prisons in California and 3 county jails. So basically, the process of victim-offender dialogue is a process of, after doing some work with separate facilitators, that victims and offenders directly of a crime, a serious crime, a murder crime, will come together and talk about what happened.
And so sometimes the victim is talking with the actual perpetrator of the crime, say if it was your husband's murderer, and sometimes it's what you call a surrogate. So
right.
It's a murderer, but not necessarily the person who killed your husband. For
right,
example.
Exactly. Okay. So, and in that process, in the VOD, we call it VOD when it's direct, in the VOD process, what victims say is there are only certain questions that the person who committed the crime can answer. Like, if it's a murder of a son, like, what did he look like on that day?
Mm.
Why him? Why did you choose him? Did you guys know each other? What was it like? Describe to me in detail. I want those questions answered, and I've been living with those questions for years and years and years. And it's an incredible sense of healing and satisfaction that someone gets from sitting across from a person who's committed harm. And that's what victims say across the board. That's what they get.
Well, let's bring Dion into this. So you were not able to confront your husband's murderer directly because he's on death row and is on appeal, which we'll talk about that kind of impediment to actually having some of this healing. But what was the process like for you to actually want to do this?
Well, you know, For many years, I carried around so much vengeance and hate, and I realized at a certain point, I had nothing left. I had no more tools. I engaged in a lot of self-destructive behavior. I tried to buy my way out of my grief. I tried to drink my way out for a short period. Thankfully, I didn't take that too far. And I just didn't have a way to move past being embroiled in that moment.
And wanting revenge?
And wanting it so badly. And through the trial, I had this little light at the end of the tunnel, and I kept thinking, it's almost over. He's going to get convicted. He's going to be on death row. I'm going to feel better. And then when it happened and he did get put on death row, I waited and I waited and I waited, and I went, wow, it really didn't work. I don't feel better. I feel worse, because now I'm let down. Now this promise of making it right within our current system, it completely let me down. And so I realized that the only way out of it was a different route. I didn't know exactly what that was, but that's kind of a long story. But I actually started realizing that the value of redemption and forgiveness.
And you wrote a letter to the murderer of your husband.
I did. Yeah, and it took me 9 months to get it to him. And it took a lot of work, a lot of searching, a lot of phone calls, a lot of begging and pleading. And I finally was put in contact with his attorney, who is a wonderful woman. And it actually took me a couple of hours of phone conversations to convince her that I didn't have any ulterior motives, that I wasn't trying to cause further harm. And I sent her my letter, and she read it to him. But because of the way our system is set up, she couldn't tell me what he said. She couldn't tell me how he responded.
Because that would be him admitting guilt.
Correct.
And he's on appeal because he's on death row.
Yes.
Is that right? So if you could actually face the alleged murder of your husband, the murder of your husband, mm-hmm. what would you want to say to him face to face? What would that be like?
I really, really at this point, because knowing that he heard my words, that was really enough to give me so much healing. It was amazing the effect that it had on me and my life. What I'd really want to say to him is to not give up on the life that he has right now, because I know that, you know, when you're sitting in a cage and you know you're going to die there, there's no question you're going to die there one way or another, that it's really easy to lose hope and think that there's no possible way you can have a positive effect on the world. But I don't believe that. I believe that he can have a positive effect on the people around him, his family. He has an opportunity, and I want him to know that that he can make a difference in his world where he is right now.
You're listening to Your Call. We're talking about restorative justice and how it's working in California prisons and jails. You just heard from Dion Wilson, who's the Survivor Outreach Coordinator for Californians for Safety and Justice. Her husband was a San Leandro police officer who was murdered, and she's been through this restorative justice process, and she says it's helped her heal and move on with her life. We're also joined by Sonia Shaw, who's the advocacy director of the Insight Prison Project, which was founded in 1997 and runs these restorative justice programs inside of San Quentin. And now we're joined on the line by Jerry Elster, who spent 27 years of a life sentence for second-degree murder. He is now a facilitator with the Insight Prison Project. So, Jerry, go back to your own process of being in one of these victim offender circles as somebody serving a life sentence in San Quentin. What was it like for you? What made you want to do this?
Okay. First of all, I think I fit the stereotype that you would believe of anybody convicted of a violent crime. I had a lot of anger in me. I came from a dispoverished community, African-American male. I was 19 years old, just turned 20. I entered the system with all that anger, blaming everybody for my problems. I never once had to really felt attached to the crime or had to really make any serious accountability, because I never had to look at my victim. I never had to even acknowledge that there was a person on the other end of that, of my crime. The state took the place of that, and it was so much easier for me to stuff everything because of my anger and stuff, feeling from what the conditions in which I grew up and a variety of other things. So it was like I really didn't care. I just wanted to be out, and I was angry. But as I started to mature inside the system, I went in. I was a troubled inmate, stayed in trouble for the first 5 years, spent in and out of isolation, and finally I said, man, this isn't right. This isn't how I want to live. So I went about trying to change myself, thinking that would make me feel better. I started to upgrade educationally. I went in reading below a seventh grade level. I achieved my first real achievement was getting my GED. I went on to get two more associate degrees, and I just still didn't feel right. And I think I had a spiritual awakening. So, I got religious. I went to church because I was just looking for some type of vindication, and I wasn't finding it that way. So I started helping others. I created help to co-found a program in San Quentin called No More Tears with two other lifer prisoners, Black Evans and Lonnie Morrison, and it was geared toward helping stop the recidivism rate and the violence that was going on in 2001 in Oakland when they hit 120-something murders. So what we did was we started working with other young inmates to educate them, to hope that, because I saw that through my education process, my anger has subsided. But even that wasn't really enough for me in helping others, because it was still something that just wasn't fulfilling. I never once had to be accountable for my crime. So I went into this program, IPP, that I heard about, was the VOGUE program, Victim Offenders Education Group, and accountability. I went in there really to get skills to help the young men that I was working with. I didn't think I could be taught anything else. And when I entered this program, man, it was earth-shattering for me. It wasn't about really helping someone else. It was about me. For the first time in my life, I learned through the restorative justice process to take self-accountability, that it wasn't the system that was the overall victim, which the system was a peripheral victim, but the overall, my real victim was the individual, and I don't want to name him because I haven't talked to his family about that or anyone, but I had a victim. There was a family. I created a funeral. I hurt a community. And the restorative justice process teaches us that through the accountability, personal accountability, there's a process where we're still a part of our community. We're still a part of the human race. We did something bad. We messed up. But it can be healing on the other side. And the healing for me came when I was able to take personal accountability for my crime and start really doing things toward my personal redemption. And I found that through the IPP. And that's why I facilitated today.
And Jerry, let me, I imagine that listeners have a lot of questions for all of you, for Sonia, for Dion, and for Jerry. We're talking about the philosophy of restorative justice, examining how it works, and really looking at what public safety means and how victims heal after a violent crime. The number to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-TALK. 8255. If you have questions about restorative justice, we want to hear them. If you have been the victim of a violent crime, let us know what you think might help your healing, what you think of this whole idea of restorative justice, and how you'd feel about being face to face with the perpetrator. 866-798-8255. The number again is 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. I want to read a comment from Rob, but Sonia, while Jerry was talking, you were nodding your head, so I wanted to make sure to get to you there.
So I wanted to just back it up and explain what the Victim Offender Education Group is, VOGUE.
Mm-hmm.
It started in 2004 by Rochelle Edwards and a group of men at San Quentin State Prison. And it's really this 52 to 80 week program in deep, deep accountability taking and healing. And the healing part is based on a philosophy that we use, that many people use in this work, that hurt people hurt people.
Mm-hmm.
So that we look at sort of unresolved trauma or unprocessed trauma in someone's life, trauma from childhood, family, school, environment, from racism, from intergenerational trauma, all of those things that might go unprocessed in someone's life.
Lack of an education, as Jerry mentioned.
Right, so not having resources, which would be that. And maybe not having strong, really strong caregivers in one's life. And there's a basic kind of connection between violence and trauma, so that if your trauma goes unprocessed, that there is a tendency to either act inwards and hurt yourself. So that's the substance abuse, that's the cutting, suicide, depression.
That's what Dion mentioned. She mm-hmm. when she was
Absolutely.
Hurting, that yeah. that was a piece of it.
And,
yeah.
and a lot of women feel that way. A lot of men do. 70% of the men inside are substance abusers, were substance abusers. And the other is the acting outwards and hurting other people. So when the men inside start to look at their past hurts and go, oh, ding, 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 this is what happened to me, and then this is how I felt, and then this is how I acted as a result, and you start to see this ricochet effect, they start to connect the dots of their lives that led to the crime.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a picture that gets painted. And when that process is done, we end in what we call a surrogate victim panel, where we bring in survivors that have had similar experiences of crime with the men inside, and they have the same kind of exchange that you would have in a victim-offender dialogue, but it's not exactly the same crime. And that's what Dion had participated in.
And that's what you participated in, yeah.
Yeah, I had the opportunity to go to the women's prison at Chowchilla and speak with a couple different groups of women who were in there for murder. And the level of accountability that I saw those ladies taking for what they had done was amazing to me, because there are things that I've done in my life, and I know they were wrong, but I didn't even know how to begin to take that kind of accountability. And they were honest. It was heartfelt. They wanted so desperately to be able to sit across from the people that they hurt and acknowledge them. And what the amazing thing that IPP does is that it allows the connection of the crime and the humanity of the person that they've hurt. That is the key to actually having people transform their lives.
Well, and one of the impediments that you all face in doing this work is that accountability isn't necessarily a part of the justice system necessarily. And a lot of people, if they have some kind of appeal or if they're on death row, can't take accountability or won't take accountability. Can you just...
Yeah, I mean, I think the point is if we're moving forward and we want to move forward, we want to remove all the barriers that are there for victims to actually meet with the folks that have committed harm against them. And there are all kinds of barriers that kind of, in the ones that Dion expressed, there are many others. And that's really what we're looking for.
Let me just try and get to one caller before we go to a break. Jane in Corte Madera, welcome to your call, Jane.
Thank you very much. This is a very interesting program, and I applaud you for doing so many programs about the prison system, and particularly San Quentin. I'm a volunteer at San Quentin, and I have sat with students in my class who are so nervous because they're going to, for the first time, the restorative justice meeting and may meet their victim for the first time, and they're just, I can't tell you how nervous they are about meeting them and talking, and they feel that they can't communicate correctly with them. But it's a very interesting process. What I would like to know from Dion is, are you relieved because your husband's murderer is on death row, or are you relieved because you know he will be executed? And the reason I ask this question is, there are about 735 men on death row right now, and almost 50 of them have been there for over 30 years. And it is my prediction that they're not ever going to be executed because of the attitude toward execution in this country, let alone around the world. Several states have already eliminated execution as a punishment.
So, Jane, I'm going to let Dion take that because we're running up against a
That's
break
fine.
Here. Thank you so much for calling. So do you want to respond to Jane?
And yeah.
We just have about a minute before the break.
Okay, no problem. So I'm really glad she asked that question because I want to clarify that although I was very much in favor of the death penalty and him being executed by the state, I have completely reversed my position on that, and I am not happy where he is. I'm not happy about the circumstances at all because there are so many barriers keeping us from having something that I believe would be extremely healing for both of us and for our families. And that I agree with her that I think there's really a stalemate in the state of California as far as the death penalty goes. That's a whole nother conversation. but the answer is no, I really... More death is not the answer to my healing.
And that's Dion Wilson. She is the Survivor Outreach Coordinator for Californians for Safety and Justice. You're listening to Your Call. We're talking about restorative justice with Sonia Shaw, the Advocacy Director of the Insight Prison Project, and Jerry Elster, who was formerly incarcerated and is now a facilitator. I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after this short break.
Your call on local public radio if you have a perspective that you'd like to add to this morning's discussion or a question you think needs to be answered, please get in touch. 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. You can also email your question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can listen to past shows and find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, how does understanding the shipping industry change the way that you understand the world? We'll have a conversation with Rose George, who's the author of 90% of Everything, Inside Shipping, the Invisible Industry That Puts Clothes on Your Back, Gas in Your Car, and Food on Your Plate. Friday is our media roundtable. We're going to talk about the budget battles in D.C., and we're going to hear why Detroit's bankruptcy didn't have to happen. Today, we're discussing the healing process behind restorative justice for both victims and perpetrators, and we're exploring whether this process can prevent crime, decrease recidivism, and contribute to public safety. And we want to invite you to join our conversation at 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. You can also send us emails to feedback@yourcallradio.org. We especially want to invite anybody who's been the victim of a violent crime to let us know what you think about the restorative justice process. If you've ever been through it, we'd like to hear your experience. And the same thing with anybody who's an ex-offender that is on the outside now, 866-798-8255. Talk is our toll-free number, 866-798-8255. Dion, right before the break, you started to talk about how your views on criminal justice have really evolved a lot through this process. Can you tell us a little bit more about kind of where you were? You were married to a police officer, where you were before and how that's changed. And then, Sonia, I want to ask you what you think real justice would look like in this system. Yeah.
Well, as you can imagine, you know, being in a law enforcement family, it's all about us versus them, really. You know, police officers have a very difficult job where they are called to deal with people at their worst possible moment. And just because my views on how the criminal justice system should work doesn't mean that I have suddenly become anti-police. I mean, quite the contrary. I want to see this system change because I believe that officer safety is at stake as well. Obviously, look what happened to my husband. There's so many aspects of what our system could be doing to not create situations like what happened to him. And I still, you know, I'm still a conservative. I still have all of my core beliefs, but being involved in this process, I've really had my eyes open to what it means to be tough on crime and really what Insight Prison Project is doing is being tough on crime. They're working toward a model where people come out of prison healed, where they come out saying, wow, my actions really do affect people just like me. And they're allowing people to see the humanity in others. And when you see the humanity in others, you're less likely to want to hurt them. And it's not that this program is not a hug-a-thug fest. It isn't, oh, you poor dear, let me make you feel better. It isn't that at all. This is real transformation that's taking place with people, and they are facilitating the things that will reduce the real drivers of crime.
And let me bring Jerry into this. I was at this meeting with Gascon, the DA of San Francisco, with a room full of men who talked, a lot of them murderers, lifers, who talked about really needing intervention as young kids. Like, do you feel like had there been some sort of restorative justice process when you were younger, I think you said you went in at 19, would that have been helpful to you as a young person, Jerry?
I went in the day after my 20th birthday. I was 19 the day before. After my 20th birthday. Would the juvenile, of course, I think that one of the things we've make a mistake in, especially with dealing with crime and social ills, we don't teach those type of processes to you. I think we should start in this before the crime happens. You know, we have civic stress. civic, some type of civic should be taught, but under restorative justice process, teach our youth to deal with issues rather than resorting to violence. You know, you got the media and everything else showing them that's the result. I mean, that's the way to resolve issues. We need to teach them the opposite side. It seems like one of the negative side is getting their point out there, but we're not getting our point out there. That's why I think it's hurting us.
That seems to be happening, Sonia, that more and more these kinds of interventions are happening. We got a comment from Rob who says, my neighbor's desire for a rehab option for the young perpetrator of an almost deadly assault, they were overridden by the Alameda County District Attorney. So he wants to know, what are the systemic obstacles to keeping young people out of prison and trying to find other options?
So there's one really amazing kind of avenue that started, and it's called restorative community conferencing. And it's a model that's based out of New Zealand. So in the 1980s, there were Maori youth that were getting locked up at a disproportionate rate. And the Maori elders were kind of like, this is not actually how we do justice. This juvenile justice system is a Western imposition. The government started a series of listening sessions and listening to the Maori elders, realizing and sort of saying, let us try a process that actually we use, which is a restorative process. And by the way, restorative justice is actually rooted in indigenous philosophies. So First Nations people of the Yukon, Maori, etc. And this modern form of restorative justice is only 40 years old in a response to the criminal justice system. So they started something called family group conferences. And basically, when a young person commits a crime, they go through a process where the young person meets with a facilitator, the victim meets with a facilitator, the community that was impacted are involved, and then you bring people together. And then by consensus, you decide on the outcome. And that outcome could be, write me a letter, write me an essay, come work in my backyard. Can you walk my kid to school for 6 months? It was so successful that in 1989, New Zealand became the first country to institutionalize family group conferences as the way that you do justice, as opposed to putting youth in the juvenile justice system.
And so what's the effect on public safety?
The effect on public safety is much, much lower recidivism, much, much lower. So,
and what about crime?
Much lower crime as well. So if you have, the outcomes are much higher. So if you have people who are going through a process that, where they're actually repairing the harm, and that's actually happening now in Oakland as well. They're doing that same model in Oakland, and they're doing it in San Francisco. So if you have a process in which people are actually understanding why they did what they did and taking accountability, the likelihood that they will not do it again is huge. So that is the impact.
And you're listening to Your Call. That's Sonia Shaw. She's the advocacy director of the Insight Prison Project that is dedicated to doing these kinds of programs inside of San Quentin. 12 prisons in California and 3 county jails. We're also joined by Dion Wilson, who's the Survivor Outreach Coordinator for Californians for Safety and Justice. Yeah, Dion.
So I just wanted to say that in case people have the impression that this movement is happening in a vacuum, it absolutely is not. Californians for Safety and Justice put out the first ever crime victim survey asking crime victims what they want, what they prefer. And we have a report that's out. And one of the questions was, do you think that California should invest more in health services like mental health and drug and alcohol treatment, or invest more in jails and prisons? And 74% of people responded that they want health services, drug treatment. We are not alone.
These are victims of violent crime.
These are actual victims of violent crime. So what...
So people are understanding that there are some root causes here that need to be addressed. I just want to give out the number one more time. I know, Sonia, there's so much to say about this, and I want to get to some of the comments that we're getting as well. If you want to join the conversation about restorative justice in prisons, it's 866-798-TALK. That's a toll-free number, 1-866-798-8255. We were having a little trouble with the phones. I think that they're fine now. So the number is 866-798-8255, or you can email us to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Okay, Sonia, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say that there is a perception out there that all victims want is revenge. There's a perception. There's a place for revenge. There's a place for anger. There's a place for hurt. There's a place for forgiveness. Healing doesn't look one way. Mm-hmm. And we don't judge that. We don't judge that at all. But This poll that came out, you know, the CSJ used the same pollster that the governor used. They polled 2,500 people in California, and 500 identified themselves as crime victims. And out of those 500 crime victims, they said what we want is rehab, rehabilitative services. What we want is more mental health, and we don't think prisons are working.
So why?
It's just an opportunity.
But you're hearing this more and more. You're hearing it from law enforcement officials. You're hearing it from crime victims, and yet we really are not seeing a huge, I mean, CDCR did put rehabilitation back into its title. They are spending more money on it, but you're just not seeing a sea change. Why?
Well, you are, because just recently the governor put out a proposal to spend $715 million to build more prisons and send prisoners out of state. And Daryl Steinberg had an alternative proposal to say, let's have more rehab services and let's have more services in general. And which one was the one that succeeded? It was Daryl Steinberg's. And that was because people came out and said, actually, what we want, what represents the voices of Californians, the constituency of Californians, is not more prisons. What we want are more services, more education, and more health. And people are willing to stand up now and say that.
Let me read a couple of emails. A comment from a caller who couldn't stay on the line. Brenda in San Francisco says, thank you for this refreshing conversation. It's great to hear that our brothers and sisters are getting healing treatment and not just punishment. Sharon says to Jerry, thank you so much for your wisdom. I'm wondering how your experience in the restorative justice process might be available to support the powerful vision of the agreement to end hostilities by the Pelican Bay Short Corridor Collective. That's the recent hunger strike by prisoners at Pelican Bay to protest solitary confinement. Go ahead. Do you want to just respond to Sharon, Jerry?
Yeah. I think that what really pulled at my heartstring about the Pelican Bay hunger strike issue, now, having done 26 and a half years in prison, I'm not one that's alien to the racial tensions and all that stuff that goes on in prison. The whole time I was in prison, never once did I see the races come together to do anything of that magnitude. Now, here we are, these guys that the system has really thrown away and given up on, has called for a cease and hostility to end racial tension and hostility toward each other. I mean, for the prisoners, especially from the population that I came from, to be able to, that's huge. And that's really what restorative justice is really about, you know. It's about recognizing the humanity and the connection we have with one another, and that we're all going to have to pull together if this is going to work. If we're going to live in peace and recognize our humanity, it can't be where it's only for a few, you know what I'm saying? It has to be across the board. And as long as we make those small compromises for the privileged or the not-so-privileged, then we won't have a peaceful society. And I applaud those men who were able to step out, and I know how far they had to step out to do that on their own. I had to make the same step, and I've seen them doing it as a group, so I'm fully in support of them on that.
That's Jerry Elster. He's formerly incarcerated. He lives in El Cerrito, and he now works as a facilitator for the Insight Prison Project. He also works for legal services for prisoners with children. We're talking about restorative justice. This is Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. I'm also joined by Sonia Shaw, who's the advocacy director of the Insight Prison Project, and Dion Wilson, who's the survivor outreach coordinator for Californians for Safety and Justice. I want to get to some calls now. Anonymous in El Cerrito, welcome to Your Call.
Oh, hi. I have the context for my question and why I didn't give a name is because I have a family member who was in a mental health facility in the state of North Carolina and was sexually abused, member there. And we are pursuing, you know, civil remedies, and but everybody's asking us, you know, if we're going to take him to court. And I'm wondering if there is a way to use restorative justice in another state. Is there a national organization or a way to approach this? That's the question. And then a concern, I'll say quickly, is can this work in terms of sexual trauma, sexual abuse cases? Because I'm worried about the furthering the sort of traumatic effect on a victim of a sex crime.
Thanks so much. Go ahead and stay on the line, Anonymous. Sonia's going to take this. Is there a national network? Is there a way to use restorative justice?
Absolutely. Restorative justice is happening nationally and internationally, and I guarantee you there's some organizations in North Carolina doing this work. I think one of the aspects or conditions almost of restorative justice is that people have to accept accountability. So whoever kind of walk into it thinking, accountability is something that I want to do. So if the person that sexually assaulted the person that you're talking about in North Carolina isn't anywhere there and they're not willing to accept responsibility, you can't force them into a process. So there has to be a place where they want to come to that process. And then on your second point, absolutely, it works with folks who have been sexually assaulted or sexually abused. I think it just has to be held very delicately. And we spend a lot of time training with facilitators and a lot of time talking about how not to re-traumatize, what that looks like. And there's a very delicate process and a very organic process, and it happens in time. We never force anybody. We do things when we're right. We meet when it's right. It could take a year or two before we're actually ready to go inside and meet with somebody.
So essentially you're working with both the victim and the perpetrator in separate processes to get them ready for this meeting.
Absolutely.
And are there certain crimes for which this is a more effective process than others?
No, not necessarily. It runs the gamut. So it's really about a willingness to change and a willingness to take accountability. And I think on a survivor side, it's a willingness to say, actually, I want to participate in this kind of healing process.
What are the impediments for the survivors to want to participate? I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of somebody who was raped or somebody like you, Dion, whose husband or child was murdered. I don't know. What does it take to get you to want to do that?
Well, I think that part of it has to do with what His Holiness the Dalai Lama told a good friend of ours. Have you been angry long enough? Has it run its course? Are you seeking something else yet? If you're still embroiled in that moment and in that hate and you're comfortable there, then it doesn't seem like this process would be very productive, because just going in and screaming at somebody is very unlikely to bring any type of positive resolution. And so I think that for both the victim and the offender, they have to be at the end of that process. They have to be saying to themselves, okay, I'm done with this. I need something else. And that's what happened with me.
Let's go to Carol in Albany. Hi, Carol. Welcome to your call.
Hi, folks. Thank you for this program and all your work. I am a facilitator. I have done conflict facilitation work, and I have been wanting to train in restorative justice because I think it's been, as everyone has reported, so effective in prisons, and I didn't hear that. I only came in on the program about 15 minutes ago, 20 minutes ago, but I think someone was talking about how it was being used in neighborhoods in general, or how this could be so effective in general in neighborhoods and communities in the world everywhere. And I would like to see it brought into communities everywhere. And I, as a facilitator, I was introduced to it on a weekend. I was very moved and very touched. And then I have been for 2 years not trying as hard as I could, I have to say, but I have been making calls to different organizations to see where I could get training in it, and I keep coming up against No trainings.
Okay, so Carol, we're gonna put that. How do people get trained in this? And then I want to get to her second question about how do we bring it into neighborhoods.
Well, I'll give you the four organizations in the Bay Area that do trainings. We do Insight Prison Project and the work that we do for schools-based trainings. You could go to Restorative Justice Training Institute or Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth, and then Community Works also does trainings.
And we will put all of this information at yourcallradio.org. Next Wednesday, we will also be talking about how restorative justice is working in schools in around Northern California. So we will continue this conversation then. But just to get to this, how do you bring this movement into neighborhoods? So I want to ask you that and piggyback on that with a question that I think I would direct mostly toward Jerry, which is a lot of the violence that's committed is by young people, young men, who often are very rash in their decision-making, just even developmentally. How do you reach them? I mean, a lot of this restorative justice work that you're talking about is happening with men who have spent sometimes decades behind bars, really spending a lot of time looking at themselves. And how do you reach somebody who's 16?
Well, I guess I would say I think there's a fallacy to think that restorative justice only applies to serious offenders or schools. It applies to my home. When my husband and I have a fight, we pass a talking piece around and we work through it in a restorative style. And so that is something that we can teach ourselves and teach each other, is just to say, you know, it really has to start at home. We think that as people who are supposedly people who haven't committed a crime, that we don't commit harm. That's not true. We commit harm all the time, all day long. And if I'm actually thinking about how I've offended people, how I take accountability, then I'm walking my talk and I'm saying, oh, you know, I'm going to practice this restoratively. And that is something that's happening a little more in communities.
And Jerry, how are you bringing it into communities?
Well, basically, I heard someone mention RJOY, Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth. And I am remiss for not even mentioning them when you asked me about how could it possibly work with our juveniles, I mean, if it was implemented on an earlier basis. RJOY has been doing just that. I've been working with RJOY on the side, volunteering with a program called CASA, Community of Support and Accountability, and where we actually work with the probation department in Alameda County for youth coming out of juvenile facilities on a collaboration with IPP, where we take these youth and we build a circle of support around these youthful people who have offended, and we're out there working with them. I also volunteer once a year. We do a thing called Silence the Violence, which is really spread across the Bay Area. I know they do it in San Francisco. I believe it is in Vallejo and Oakland. I'm with the Oakland Silence the Violence, so I'm out there really talking about my story and talking about the connection with my story and the restorative justice resolution that I was able to acquire.
And Jerry, let's try and get to one more call. Nancy in Berkeley, welcome to your call.
Well, thank you. I just want to thank you for having next week a program about schools, because it would be very safe for all of us to have decent public schools, rather than give people an education while they're in jail on death row. So that was my comment.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Nancy, and that gives me just a minute to have each of you wrap up. What are your top priorities for reforming the criminal justice system? And we're running out of time, so just
okay.
Briefly, Dion, you first.
Sure. So I think a top priority in my view is to really change the conversation on what it means to be tough on crime, because that seems to be a favorite political football that, you know, people in power toss back and forth. Look how tough I am. Look, no, I'm tougher. Well, you're not solving the problem. That's evident. So we need to change our direction. And that's why I'm so delighted that there are programs like IPP out there, and why I'm so excited to work with Californians for Safety and Justice. And we just need to change the conversation.
Just change the conversation. Jerry, you get 30 seconds. Top priority for reform.
To build a collaboration with the community on both sides those who have offended and those who haven't been, who has been offended. We build a collaboration where we work together toward healing.
Thank you. And Sonia, you get the last word here. What would you prioritize?
So I said it earlier, removing the barriers for victims. The second thing is letting us do restorative processes, more funding, more opportunity. And the third is there have been nine prisons that were built from 1852 to 1980, and then another 25 built in the last 30 years. We have to stop this thinking that public safety has anything to do with building prisons. Mm-hmm. We are not safer because we have more prisons. And so we can participate in that conversation as Californian citizens, basically, to say that's not what this is about. This is about services. This is about restoration and rehabilitation.
Right. And building prisons is also extremely expensive, monetarily, as well as impact on society.
Right. And it costs $8 to $1. $1 for a restorative process versus $8 to send someone into a criminal justice system process.
And we're going to continue this conversation next Wednesday, really looking at restorative justice at the younger ages in schools as a new model for discipline and healing. You've been listening to Your Call. We'll put links to all of the information at yourcallradio.org. I want to thank my guests. Sonia Shaw is the Advocacy Director of the Insight Prison Project. She is also a Professor of Interdisciplinary Studies at the California Institute of Integral Studies. We've also been joined by Dionne Wilson, who's the Survivor Outreach Coordinator for Californians for Safety and Justice. Thank you for joining us. And Jerry Elster has been on phone from El Cerrito. He works for legal services for prisoners with children under a project called All of Us Are None. He participated in the Insight Prison Project programs when he was serving time for murder in San Quentin, and he is now a facilitator on the outside. Thanks to everybody who joined us for your emails and phone calls, and I'm sorry we couldn't get to everybody. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. How is the ability to ship goods globally affecting the world? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with author and reporter Rose George about her recent book, 90% of Everything, Inside Shipping, the Invisible Industry that Puts Clothes on Your Back, Gas in Your Car, and Food on Your Plate. What do you want to know about the industry that has so much effect on our lives but remains mostly hidden? Join the conversation and call in with your questions on the next Your Call with Matt Martin and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALD. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.